Welcome to the Finance Path Podcast, where we discuss all your burning questions relating to money, property, and investment for every stage of life. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Attard and Chris Collard.
Hey, listeners, welcome to the Money, Property, and You podcast. You're with Mark Attard, Director of Mortgage Management Company Finance Path, and today I'm joined by Brad Strahair of Domain Property Advocates. Welcome, Brad.
Morning, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's a it's actually a beautiful winter's day this morning. I thought had a look at the outlook, and I thought it was going to be quite wet and windy and a classic Melbourne winter's day. But I'm tipping it was still pretty chilly out your neck of the woods. You're about an hour. I won't give away your address. I know you're not you don't want the paparazzi, but I'm tipping it was pretty cold out your neck of the woods.
No, I do live in the hills. It was icy this morning, hence I've got a 3-piece suit on just to keep the chest warm.
I don't know about whether the 3-piece suit is because you're trying to keep warm. That's the standard get-up, I understand.
Oh, it's all right.
Is that a little marketing thing for yourself when you're out and about, your little point of difference?
Not at all. It's just to keep warm in winter.
Cool. We're talking about the weather. There's, you know, adages around when's the best time to buy and sell. So before we get into lifting the lid on property advocacy, have you got any thoughts and in your experiences around weather and the impact, I suppose, that it can have on the best time to buy and sell and people's moods, etc., etc.?
I think it's changed more recently than when I first started. I think certainly, you know, 10 or 11 years ago, there was clear timing in the marketplace where there was more activity or more people were buying or selling. Whereas I think now people are just attuned to buying when they're ready.
Yeah.
Some of the best auctions I've been to in terms of results have been where it's been pouring with rain and the auction's gone inside and you're in a little living room with 3 or 4 bidders. Mm. And it just seems to be that sort of intense environment brought out the competitive nature in people.
Yeah, interesting.
So I think that's changed a lot. And I think it is now just down to people can afford to buy.
Yep.
Doesn't matter about the season or the conditions. It's, I want the property, I want to buy it, I'll pay whatever, I'll do whatever it takes to
Yeah, buy. It's interesting because, we sold a property last year and we sold it through winter, which was traditionally a time that most people would say, okay, well, no, the numbers aren't necessarily going to be there from a purchaser's perspective. We achieved a really, really sound result. And as you said, I think if the people are interested and they're ready to buy and they know they can buy, the weather doesn't necessarily have such a big impact.
No, I mean, there's certain areas and types of properties that are obviously going to perform better. A beachside place in Sorrento, you know, peak of summer, obviously.
Yeah.
A chalet, you know, in the snow sort of thing. So I think there's certain types of properties and locations that are obviously dependent on seasonals.
Yep.
And seasonal change. But anything that's sort of Melbourne-based, sometimes you're better off selling in winter because there is less properties to compete with. But I think, as I said, people are attuned to buy when they can afford to.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, today I wanted to lift the lid, per se, on property advocacy. We're seeing through our mortgage management business certainly a lot more buyers that are actually engaging and purchasing properties through buyer's advocates. And we're getting increased inquiry with regards to how do they go about sourcing a property advocate? How does the whole thing basically work? So I thought today would be a really good opportunity for you to give us a little bit of a background. Firstly, on your experience, how did you get into the industry and what were you doing, I suppose, in your lead up to your role now with Domain?
So I've been an advocate or in the advocacy business now for 11 years. Prior to that, I actually had my own marketing business. And our first client was a property investment business. They didn't really sort of refer to themselves as an advocate, but their role was essentially an advocacy business. And being a marketing consultant, I grew that, well, myself and my business partner grew that that business pretty rapidly. And at that time, they needed some people to help, you know, talking to clients and selling the services, which I really enjoyed doing. And I said, I'll put my hand up and help out, and loved it. And that was 11 years ago. And then throughout the course of that time, I've worked for a few different companies and in the last sort of 4 years been at Domain and gone from an advocate to a partner and now a director as of the last sort of few weeks. So
So in domain, so give us a little bit of an understanding of what the property advocacy marketplace looks like. So we come from an industry, our business is a mortgage management business, mm-hmm. and so to a lot of people, they don't necessarily know what that is. There's not a lot of us in the space. But if you say mortgage broker, everybody knows about mortgage brokers. Over 50% of loans originated or written now are done through mortgage brokers. So we're quite a small, unique little business that's bundled in with a hell of a lot of others out mm-hmm. there. Talk to us about the actual marketplace of advocates, you know, and maybe just specifically here in Melbourne. How are they big businesses? Are they small businesses? How does the how does it work?
I think I know that you guys, you know, when you do your presentations, you like you're using analogies and things like that. And I think one of the easiest things, particularly for your listeners to understand, would be where brokers have come from. And brokers are originally formulated from a bank. They've come from a big bank. They've decided that they can do it better or they want personal service and they've gone out and done it themselves. And that's how advocacy has sort of grown, is people were once real estate agents. They felt they can represent buyers better than sellers or vice versa. And they decide to go out and create a service or a business that helps one specific party, being the buyer and buyer advocacy, to go out and help them to purchase their properties. And typically there's probably about three or four larger companies, and I'd consider Domain as one of those,
yep.
That have been around for sort of 15 plus years. And over the journey of that sort of 15 years, you see staff come and go. And what do people then do is, well, I can do it myself. And then they go out and create another advocacy business. And what become four is now eight, and then eight is 16 and 32 and so on and so forth. So that's the natural progression of how I've seen advocates change over the last 10 or 11 years. And it's interesting because they go from big companies to smaller one-man operations or a team of two or three or whatever it may be. And now when I'm out there on a Saturday at an auction, there are times where I turn up and there's three or four or five other advocates. And depends on who you see and depends on how they operate. You know, you have a fair understanding of how the day is going to unfold.
Yeah, that's a really interesting scenario that I was going to ask you a little bit down. But while you're further down the track, but while you brought it up, that process, because if it's become a more competitive landscape out mm-hmm. there, and so clients may, as you said, in days gone by, had just the option if they wanted to go down that path of using an advocate of one or two businesses, three or four, and then natural, everybody, I think in most industries, spread their wings, they say, I want to go and have a crack myself.
Mm.
How hard is it then for the smaller operators per se, or the one and two men shows, to get some traction in the marketplace? And as it's becoming more and more competitive, how do businesses go on? How do advocates sort of differentiate themselves from the competition? Because our industry is very much like that. It's a real challenge for a lot out there to be able to, I suppose, differentiate their service and their product offering from the man down the street.
Yeah, there's probably a couple of small differences if you sat down and interviewed five different advocates. The service that they provide is predominantly the same, but there's probably, you know, the nuances, the smaller differences that one might stand out from the next. And that can be structure, fee structure, it could be philosophies, it could be types of properties, it could be the method or the process that they go through to find the properties. But I've always said to any client that's walked in the door, whether it's a direct referral or someone that's Googled or whatever it may be, is that if you interview five different advocates, we're all predominantly going to tell you the same sort of thing. But if you're about to invest $500,000, $1 million, $2 million, whatever it is, you have to have complete faith and confidence in that the person you're going to employ is going to do the right thing by you. Irrespective of if they've got the bells and whistles or not, if you don't trust them, don't employ that person. And I think that's, for me, something that a lot of people, when you sit down with them, they go, okay, well, that's really, really salient advice.
Yeah.
And a lot of the business, a lot of people who are looking to use advocates should do some research, but I still think that the best way to be put in front of one of the better advocates is through a referral.
Mm.
A warm referral is better than anything else.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned there's a couple of things I wanted to follow through on there. You talked about when you rock up to an auction these days, and you'll know quite a few in the crowd, and they may be fellow advocates. How long does it take you? And this is, I dare say, one of the advantages or the value propositions that you offer as an advocate. To sum up the crowd at an auction, like when you rock up, what are you looking for, and how quickly can you sort of get a feel for the way it's going to pan out? Or, you know, sometimes they just, they go a totally different way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing that still excites me, to be perfectly honest. That's kind of like the game day, you know. You rock up and you're trying to work out how the other team's going to play, what are their strategies, how have they played the week before and things like that. So for me, that's me turn up to the MCG at 2 o'clock on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy the process of trying to pick who the other bidders are. And advocates are easy because you see them week in, week out. And they're quite often the person that's dressed in the suit, some cases acting like a bit of a fool. But they're the easy part. The part that is the harder part is your mum and dad or your young couple or whoever, who are those out there looking to buy their first home or their first investment property. And a classic, and this only happened 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was at a house and it was over in Greensboro and I was looking at buying something out there for a first home buyer. And when I walked in, I tend to get there first, but I don't walk in first, I tend to watch other people walking in.
Is that just so that you can sit there and find out who's going to be there?
That's all it is.
Yeah. Not about being too keen and being like the first one in. You just want to sum up who's turning up.
So I've got a general rule that the first person there is a buyer because they've got that nervous energy and they want to go back and see it, make sure it's good, got mum and dad in tow and all that sort of stuff. The person that goes straight to a contract, they're reading the rules and the regulations and what's there and the like. But if you're prepared, you shouldn't need to read that again. It's just nervousness trying to, you know, do the right thing.
Yeah.
But 2 or 3 weeks ago in Greensboro, I walked in, there was a guy sitting down on the couch. And he was sitting down on the couch and he was talking quite openly to his partner about certain things. And I actually walked past and said, mate, you've already moved in. And he sort of looked at me like, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you're sitting down and, you know, you've got your legs up and you don't want to get you a coffee sort of thing. And sure enough, he was the actual buyer. So psychology or whatever it is, he's actually, in his own mind, irrespective of dollars, he's already moved into the house.
Yeah.
So I've sort of picked up that guy there is going to be my competition. Sure enough, he bid strongly and he bought the property, he had the most money. So I look for things like that. So all those sorts of clues help me when it comes to bidding as to, do I start strong? Do I wait at the end? Do I wait and see, you know, who's out there? If I can pick 2 or 3 or 4 people and they've bid pretty aggressively from the beginning, then it gets towards the end and they've slowed down, I can then sort of confidently say to myself, okay, I don't think there's anyone else here now. Now it's time for me to get involved. And then that's how I approach it.
So you're talking there about bidding strategies, which is really interesting because you'll hear, and this is part of the challenge, I think, for the people out there that are looking to buy properties. There's a lot of information out in the marketplace, whether it be to do with how to finance their property, loans, how to bid at auctions, etc. It's really a suck it and see, and you have to adjust your process. Yeah. You don't have a set way about going about it. Is that the way you sort of operate?
Yeah, absolutely. Quite often a client will say to me, oh, what's your strategy? And I talk to a lot of clients on Friday afternoons in terms of preparation for Saturday. I said, what's your strategy? And I said, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? I said, well, I don't really know until I get there. I've got an understanding or an idea on how I want it to play out. But until I get there on the day, I don't know. It might be a situation where, you know, the expectations are 3 or 4 people there, but there's only about 10 people in the crowd. So how that plays out is completely different to when you turn up and there's, you know, 100 people there, and there's a 3 or 4 people that are showing interest. That's completely different. Actually, for one of your clients last weekend, I turned up to a property and my strategy at that, going up to the property was to be aggressive. I knew that they had an offer of $680 that they rejected, but I thought it was going to be sort of $730, $740. And my strategy was to open up at sort of $680, $690, and the person that offered $680 would sort of be a bit deflated. In the end, when I turned up, there was a crowd of about 80 people there, probably about 3 or 4 bidders, and I didn't end up bidding because there was 2 people that started at $600, got to $750 very, very quickly. So all your best laid plans sometimes don't even work. Don't even bid sometimes.
It was funny. I was actually at an auction in our street on the weekend, and lovely California bungalow. And the expectation that the sellers, we knew who they are. and they didn't need to sell. They were the classic scenario where they were looking to downsize, capitalise on a strong market, etc. Anyway, so this property passed in. There was quite a few people there, but I'll be honest, I thought there'd be a few more. And the auctioneer had just come from a previous auction maybe five streets away and had a ridiculous result, blown out of the water. And so came in clearly expecting a really good result. And there was a couple of bidders, but the bidders from the start were working on like $5,000 increments, mm-hmm. right? And we're talking about $1 million plus property here. So you just got the feel straight away that it was going to be a bit of a tough gig for him. Interesting enough, though, a week later, a buyer who was not at the auction, hadn't even looked at the property, ended up paying around about $100,000 more than what the highest offer was on the day. And so it's just one of those things. Sometimes you just don't know.
No, that's right. And that's why I say to a lot of buyers, a lot of clients, is you just don't know sometimes. So if you're thereabouts, I'd rather us be there and miss out rather than just not be there, and you go, you know what, I would have bought it for that sort of amount. So sometimes you just don't know.
Yeah. You talked before about the growth of the industry and how it's sort of a business of eight becomes one of four, and then two will go out and start up their own thing. As advocates, and you shared with us your journey, but who is it normally made up of? Do you find that you said before it was real estate agents, or is it people coming from a totally different industry to make it up? Like, and what are their motivations? Is it easy to sort of to pin down a sort of type of person that makes up the industry?
Yeah, that's a tough one. The easy answer is that a lot of them are real estate agents who either find that they're working too long hours, or it's too competitive, or a lot of real estate agents who see other agents become advocates, so they didn't cut it and all that sort of stuff. So it's really interesting. There's some out there who are valuers. You know, they're valuers, and certain valuation firms operate on, you know, being paid per valuation. They didn't like that process.
Yep.
But they've got a passion for property and the like. There's some that have just a service industry because, believe it or not, a lot of people that come in say we love property, that we're looking to employ. So it's nothing about property. It's about service. It's about clients and all those sorts of things. So
that's interesting, because I would dare say that a lot of people that would walk in and say, hey, it's like people that come into our industry and say they had a passion for numbers. Yeah, okay, that's a little bit a part of it, but it's a small part of it.
Yeah, that's right. Our receptionist, when we were interviewing her, came in and said, what do you want to do? She says, I like learning and I like people and I like service.
Yep.
She said, and property's the kind of thing that I sort of see as something that I'll enjoy. Great. Because she's got, it's all about the people and the like. So I think that the people that come into this industry are a combination of ex-real estate agents, valuers, a passion for people. Some have a passion for property. As I said, I sort of fell into it, but I saw that what they were doing for people in terms of helping them to whether it's buy their first home or to build a portfolio or to help them financially or whatever it may be, and that was the attraction for me.
Yeah.
I get a kick out of going to people's housewarming parties or first birthdays or whatever at their new house and stuff like that. That's pretty cool to me.
So our listeners are here and they're going, okay, I've got a bit of a better understanding of how the industry is made up. And they want to make some further inquiries with regards to engaging a property advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Talk us through the questions that they should be asking to make sure that they are leading them on a path to say, this is someone that ultimately I'm going to feel comfortable working with.
Yeah. I think experience is one thing. I think that somebody that you're looking to represent you in the marketplace must have knowledge of the marketplace. There's a story a few years ago that somebody won Buyer's Advocate of the Year. It was a Buyer's Advocate in Melbourne for less than 12 months. He's from Sydney with no experience. How can somebody employ that person? So I think experience in the marketplace is critical. And it's experience in the Melbourne marketplace. There's no point having somebody from Sydney or Brisbane has moved to Melbourne and employing them, because they don't know the Melbourne market. They might know the processes and the like, but if you don't know the intricacies of pockets within pockets or streets to stay away from or which agent will do this and that sort of stuff, I think that you're doing yourself a disservice. So experience, Understanding the philosophies about buying properties and what makes a good property and the reasons why and the locations and the like. What they do to find properties, because at the end of the day, anybody can sit on realestate.com or domain.com and search properties. What other methods they use to find them. Fee is important.
Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit more. So is it a pretty uniform way in which advocates charge how do advocates make a decision on how they charge for their time?
There's usually two ways. It's either a fixed fee or a percentage.
Okay.
I've worked in both. And we offer both to clients, depending on their circumstances. When I was working on the fixed fee side, the argument was don't use someone with a percentage because the more that you pay, the more that you pay them as a fee. The reality is that as an advocate, you need to demonstrate value, and you need to demonstrate the value of a price of a property that you're prepared to pay for. So if a property is worth $500,000 and I go and I'm charging you 2%, and I go and pay $700,000, I make 0 cents. I'm actually doing it just to make more money. But if it's $500,000, I tell you to buy it for $510,000 or $520,000, you're just paying market value. So there's no real value in me for you to pay more, because if you pay $500,000 or $520,000, the difference is about $100 in terms of fee. It's not a lot of money. So I think that's really irrelevant.
Yeah, okay.
It's just dependent on how a business decides to structure their fees. And a lot of people who offer fixed fees, it's a percentage base, just put in a fixed dollar amount. That's all it is. And the industry as a whole is purely based on roughly 2%, give or take, depending on the market and the area that you're in.
Yeah, okay.
But I think that as long as you know what your fee is up front, it's fine.
Yeah. And so what's the... Can you give us a picture of... And there may not be. There could be a range of it, but the type of client that comes to you and finds value in the advocacy business.
The people who I see who value it more than anybody else are those who are a professional or a business owner themselves that charge a fee for their time. Because the majority of people that we work with are time poor. And everyone hears that, oh, time poor, I've got the same hours as everybody else. But the fact is that some people just work so long hours that they just can't do it themselves. They outsource it. We're living in a world now where everything's outsourced. So that's number one. Number two is inexperience, particularly with investors. You can be inexperienced as an owner-occupier, but you like a certain type of property in a certain area, and that's what's driving you to buy that sort of property. But as an investor, if you get something right, you can make significant money, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. If you get it wrong, you can lose. You may not lose money, but you lose that opportunity of growth, and you could lose 100 or, again, millions of dollars. So, again, inexperience is what people come to, and they get that guidance and that advice and that support. There's some that just don't like the process. They don't like the process of going out looking at, 10 properties on a Saturday, giving your name and number to 10 agents, and then getting 10 phone calls every week for the next 10 weeks.
And dealing with real estate agents. That can be quite off-putting. And let's face it, there's probably a trust issue there.
Yeah.
And people are quite wary of those in that industry. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, even dealing with them. Yeah.
And then there's those that are all three. If you sort of have your three circles, they overlap. There's a bit of everything. So that's the main reasons why people would use someone like ourselves. And that's the majority of our clients.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much for your time this morning. I think off the back of this, there's just so much stuff that we could talk about. Mm. I was talking before about the amount of information that's out there that sometimes can hold people back from actually doing anything. Mm. Sometimes too much information is actually an inhibitor to somebody moving forward. So I'd love to catch up again maybe next week and have another chat and start to understand a little bit more about that process that you talked about. Like, how do you go about sitting down with a client and in your own head determining the best, not necessarily strategy for purchase, but also what makes a great investment?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Well, guys, that's it for today. I encourage you to jump onto our website, www.financepath.com.au, and type in some questions, jump on there, or you can also just email our customer service at financepath.com.au. Shoot through your questions. There may be some questions for Brad, a little bit more off the back of what we've discussed today, and we'll look at answering them for you next week. Thanks, guys. Catch up soon.
For more information about this podcast or to ask a burning question, visit www.financepath.com.au/podcasts.